Thank you. Thank you so much. It's really a pleasure to be here today to discuss the management of the Federal Reserve's balance sheet. I want to thank Mark for reaching out to me and inviting me. And I really look forward to engaging this group in particular. I know some of you from my previous life as a consultant, and so it's good to see many of you again. So a few things have changed from my previous life. One of them is when I speak at conferences like this, you know, it's very rigid. I have to prepare a script and pretty much stick to that script since it's publicly released and so on. But let me start by kind of veering off the script for a minute. So that didn't take too long. Now, actually, I thought it would help to start by clarifying, you know, what I do and maybe more importantly, what I don't do. So as Mark mentioned, I run the markets group at the New York Fed, and I'm appointed manager of the System Open Market Account, or the SOMA. The SOMA is the portfolio of securities that the Fed has accumulated in its conduct of monetary policy. So it doesn't include, say, the Maiden Lanes and so on, but it's the main part of the balance sheet with all the investments in treasuries, agencies, and MBS. So in this capacity, what I oversee is the implementation of monetary policy decisions. So actually conducting operations with the market and actually managing the portfolio. And of course involved in this is a lot of analysis and advice to the FOMC on what the balance sheet may be doing and more broadly what's taking place in markets. Of course, and I know everyone in this room knows this, but it's good to state, policy decisions themselves reside with the FOMC, the Federal Open Market Committee. So just to be clear, you know, I will not be speaking for the FOMC or for the Federal Reserve System more broadly. I think we need to listen to them for any signals about policy prospects. But what I will do is talk a lot about some of the issues surrounding balance sheet decisions to hopefully give you some more background on the way we're thinking about some of these issues. So the Federal Reserve currently holds more than $2 trillion of securities in its portfolio, making it a key participant in U.S. fixed income markets. Moreover, the portfolio is managed in a manner that differs from any other market participant, as the FOMC has adjusted the size and the composition of the portfolio with the intention of achieving its monetary policy objectives of full employment and stable prices. Thus, it is important for market participants to understand the balance sheet decisions of the FOMC and the implementation of those decisions to fully assess the implications for fixed income markets. The evolution of the balance sheet going forward will depend on how the economic outlook unfolds. The current forecast of FOMC members show the economy moving in the right direction. So we see a sustained recovery in GDP, a gradual reduction in the unemployment rate over time, and an increase in inflation towards the level that FOMC members see as desirable over the intermediate term. However, the anticipated recovery is relatively tepid, and thus it delivers only slow progress towards meeting the Federal Reserve's dual mandate. Indeed, according to the most recently published forecast of FOMC members, they expect the unemployment rate to remain above 8.25% through 2011, and the inflation rate to remain below its mandate consistent level through 2012. In addition, the economy remains vulnerable to downside surprises that could take both output and inflation further away from the FOMC's objectives. The sluggish outlook for the economy and the risks that surround that outlook have raised the possibility of further monetary policy accommodation. The most recent FOMC statement indicated that the committee, quote, is prepared to provide additional accommodation if needed to support the economic recovery and to return inflation over time to levels consistent with its mandate. The FOMC has several policy tools that it could use to achieve more accommodative financial conditions, as Chairman Bernanke discussed in his speech at the Jackson Hole Symposium in August. My remarks today will focus on one of those options, changing the size of the Federal Reserve's holdings of securities. In particular, I will review the FOMC's recent decision to keep the size of those security holdings at its current level, and I will discuss some of the issues to be considered in any decision on whether to expand them further. So So let me begin with the decision to reinvest maturing asset holdings. So the initial decisions by the FOMC to expand the Federal Reserve's holdings of securities came at the height of the financial crisis. Before that time, the Federal Reserve maintained a relatively simple portfolio of between $700 and $800 billion of Treasury securities, largely the amount needed to offset the currency in circulation. In late November 2008, in the face of tightening financial conditions and a deep downturn in economic activity, the Federal Reserve announced that it would purchase up to $600 billion of agency debt and agency mortgage-backed securities. In March 2009, it expanded the program to include cumulative purchases of up to $1.75 trillion of agency debt, agency MBS, and longer-term Treasury securities. The use of the balance sheet in this manner was spurred in part by the inability to ease policy using the traditional policy instrument, as the federal funds rate effectively reached the lower bound in late 2008. The asset purchases were carried out from December 2008 through March 2010 by the trading desk at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, resulting in a significant expansion of the Federal Reserve's portfolio. And as I mentioned, so the trading desk is part of the markets group that I run, and I'm going to refer to it repeatedly as just the desk as I go. As the settlement of these purchases progressed, the amount of domestic securities held in the SOMA reached a peak of $2.1 trillion in June 2010. From that point, the portfolio began to shrink because the agency debt and agency MBS held in the SOMA were being allowed to run off without reinvestment as they matured or were prepaid. So against that backdrop, an important policy decision regarding the Federal Reserve's portfolio was made at the August FOMC meeting, when the committee decided to halt this runoff and hold the size of the SOMA portfolio steady. To achieve this, the FOMC directed the desk to purchase longer-term Treasury securities as needed to offset any principal payments realized on our holdings of agency debt and agency MBS. This was not just a symbolic policy decision, but instead involved a meaningful shift in the path of the balance sheet. At the time of the meeting, the desk was projecting that nearly $400 billion of the Federal Reserve's agency debt and MBS holdings would be paid down from that point through the end of 2011. The decision to reinvest those funds therefore amounted to a sizable program to purchase longer-term Treasury securities. Now, the effect of asset purchases on the economy remains a point of ongoing debate, with some uncertainty about the channels through which such purchases operate and the magnitude of those effects. My own perspective is aligned with the view expressed by Chairman Bernanke and Jackson Hole that the effects arise primarily through a portfolio balance channel. Under that view, our asset holdings keep longer-term interest rates lower than otherwise by reducing the aggregate amount of risk that the private private markets have to bear. In particular, by purchasing longer-term securities, the Federal Reserve removes duration risk from the market, which should help to reduce the term premium that investors demand for holding longer-term securities. That effect should in turn boost other asset prices, as those investors displaced by the Fed's purchases would likely seek to hold alternative types of securities. Some research studies have estimated that the effects of the earlier expansion of our securities holdings by just over $1.5 trillion, lowered longer-term Treasury yields by about 50 basis points through this portfolio balance channel. These effects on Treasury yields appear to have been transmitted into lower rates on private credit instruments and higher asset prices more broadly. Now, under this view, the FOMC's influence on financial conditions is associated with the size and composition of its securities portfolio. This perspective provides a clear rationale for the reinvestment decision that was made at the August FOMC meeting. The decline in the size of the Federal Reserve's portfolio that would have occurred in the absence of the reinvestment program would have amounted to a passive tightening in the stance of monetary policy, as the portfolio balance effect would have gradually reversed. Moreover, the extent of this tightening was increasing in response to a weakening of the economy, as lower longer-term yields were leading to a more rapid repayment of our MBS holdings. So this perverse effect was seen by the FOMC as working against its efforts to reach its dual mandate, leading to the reinvestment decision. So far I've talked about the FOMC's August policy decision. However, you may also be interested in the details of how the desk has actually implemented the reinvestment policy. So let me touch on that for a few minutes. So the instructions from the FOMC to the desk after the August meeting were to keep the total face value of domestic securities held in the SOMA portfolio near their level at that time. The published size of the securities portfolio just ahead of the August meeting was $2.054 trillion. So the desk adopted this level as the target for the portfolio. This is a notable development by itself because the directive from the FOMC to the desk now involved two targeted variables. So the target range for the federal funds rate and the target size for its asset holdings. To implement this directive, the desk has been purchasing Treasury securities on a monthly schedule. In particular, we announce a plan around the middle of each month for the purchase operations to take place through the middle of the following month once we know the principal repayments that will be received over that period. We are running at a pace of $27 billion of purchases this month, and we expect that pace to bump up to around $30 billion for the next several months. Looking further ahead, we currently project that the cumulative amount of principal payments on agency debt and MBS through 2011 will be modestly higher than the estimates provided at the August FOMC meeting. I should note that the directive to the desk is expressed in terms of the overall size of the portfolio. However, under the portfolio balance model described earlier, the effects on markets will be tied to the amount of duration risk that such purchases encompass. Thus, the composition of purchases across maturities will be quite important in governing the effects on financial conditions. The strategy that the desk has employed for the reinvestment program is to follow the pattern of purchases that was implemented in the earlier Treasury purchase program. The purchases will be concentrated in nominal Treasury securities with remaining maturities of 2 to 10 years, but with some purchases also occurring outside this segment. The average duration of the securities purchased is expected to be just over 5 years, although the exact realized outcome will depend on the offers that we receive in our operations. Under this approach, the purchases will remove a considerable amount of duration from the market relative to what the market would have held without reinvestments by the Federal Reserve. The reinvestment strategy, of course, also involves a reallocation of our portfolio from agency debt and MBS into Treasury securities. The FOMC's decision to reallocate was based on a variety of factors. However, one consideration was whether purchasing Treasury securities would have an effect on longer-term interest rates comparable to that of purchasing MBS. My view was that the effects would be similar because purchasing longer-term Treasury securities removes as much duration risk from the market as purchasing current coupon MBS. The two approaches do differ, however, in that purchasing MBS also removes prepayment risk from the market. If the market were to begin to have trouble digesting that prepayment risk, the spread between MBS rates and Treasury yields could widen. A significant widening of MBS spreads to Treasuries, whether due to this or other factors, could affect policymakers' decisions about which assets to purchase. The chairman's speech in Jackson Hole and the August FOMC minutes both indicated that reinvestments into MBS rather than Treasury securities might become desirable if market conditions were to change. So as you can see, the decision to simply keep the balance sheet unchanged involved a number of considerations and choices. Let me now turn to the possibility that the FOMC could go a step further and expand the balance sheet beyond its current levels. So as you're well aware, this policy option has been the focus, has been the subject of intense focus among market participants in recent weeks. Chairman Bernanke indicated back in August that any decision about expanding the balance sheet would depend on the FOMC's assessment of the costs and benefits involved. Of course, that assessment is very difficult to calibrate. Federal Reserve Bank of New York President William Dudley discussed many of the relevant issues in his speech last Friday. In terms of the benefits, balance sheet expansion appears to push financial conditions in the right direction, in that it puts downward pressure on longer-term real interest rates and makes broader financial conditions more accommodative. One can reach that judgment based on the empirical evidence from the earlier round of asset purchases, as I mentioned before. In addition, market responses to more recent news about the balance sheet also seem to lean in this direction. The market response to the reinvestment decision at the August FOMC meeting seemed largely in line with the estimated effects from the earlier round of asset purchases, once we account for the size of the surprise and the anticipatory pricing that occurred ahead of the announcement, and the increased expectations for balance sheet expansion in response to the September FOMC statement also generated a sizable market response. To be sure, I think it's fair to say that this is an imperfect policy tool. Even under the estimates noted earlier, the Federal Reserve had to increase its security holdings considerably to induce the estimated 50 basis point response of longer-term rates. In addition, there is a large degree of uncertainty surrounding the estimates of these effects, given our limited experience with this instrument. Lastly, it is reasonable to assume that the effects of balance sheet expansion would diminish at some point, especially if yields were to move to extremely low levels. Nevertheless, the tool appears to be working, and it is not clear that we have yet reached a point of diminishing effects. Some observers have argued that the balance sheet changes, even if they induce movements in longer-term interest rates, will not affect the economy because the transmission mechanism is broken. This point is overstated, in my view. It is true that certain aspects of the transmission mechanism are clogged because of credit constraints facing some households and businesses. And it is true that monetary policy cannot directly target those parties that are the most constrained. Nevertheless, balance sheet policy can still lower longer-term borrowing costs for many households and businesses, and it adds to household wealth by keeping asset prices higher than they otherwise would be. It seems highly unlikely that the economy is completely insensitive to these and other changes in broad financial conditions. In terms of the cost of balance sheet expansion, that assessment is perhaps even more complicated than assessing the benefits. I'm not going to attempt a comprehensive discussion of the costs, because that assessment really falls to the FOMC. But as manager of the SOMA, I will speak about two of the potential operational challenges involved, one associated with implementing additional asset purchases, and one associated with exiting from them. On the implementation of a program, an important consideration is whether Federal Reserve purchases would strain the functioning of financial markets and cause an erosion of market liquidity. This consideration would be particularly relevant if the FOMC decided that a fairly sizable program was needed to have a meaningful effect on financial conditions and the economy. This issue was present during the first asset purchase program, especially when the pace of weekly purchases reached a peak of about $40 billion in the middle of last year. The pace of those purchases at times put pressure on liquidity in the MBS market, leading the desk to take mitigating actions when possible. In the current circumstances, there would seem to be room for the Federal Reserve to expand its holdings of Treasury securities without creating difficulty for market functioning. The SOMA currently holds about 12% of the outstanding stock of coupon securities, a smaller share than was held before the financial crisis. Moreover, the supply of Treasury securities will remain ample, as the Treasury is expected to issue around $1.2 trillion of securities over the next year. Any purchase program that the FOMC decides upon, whether aimed at Treasury securities or MBS, would be designed to support market functioning as much as possible while still achieving the program's economic objectives. The deep liquidity of these markets has considerable value to our economy, and we should take whatever steps possible to leave this liquidity intact. The second operational challenge I mentioned comes at the other end of the program, the exit. In particular, it's important to consider whether balance sheet expansion would complicate the eventual exit of the Federal Reserve from its accommodative policy stance. I am confident that our ability to exit will not be compromised by any further expansion of the balance sheet. The exit strategy that is ultimately implemented will have to take into account the size and composition of the balance sheet at that time. However, in all potential circumstances, the Federal Reserve should be able to tighten financial conditions to a sufficient degree when appropriate. The ability to pay interest on reserves, in combination with the ability to drain reserves as needed, will give us sufficient control of short-term interest rates. On that front, it's worth noting that both of the Federal Reserve's draining tools, the reverse repurchase program and the term deposit facility, are already operational, and their capacity to drain reserves will continue to expand. In addition, the Federal Reserve could always sell assets to reduce the size of its balance sheet if it desired. If the FOMC were to move forward with an expansion of the balance sheet, it would presumably want to take into consideration the perspective gained from the asset purchases conducted from late 2008 to early 2010. The FOMC would have to decide the extent to which a purchase program would follow the approach from that earlier round of purchases. An alternative approach would be to design a purchase program that shares more of the features of the FOMC's adjustment of the federal funds rate in normal times. After all, adjustments to the balance sheet are in many respects a substitute for changes in the federal funds rate. Both instruments attempt to influence broader financial conditions in order to achieve a desired economic outcome. However, the way in which the FOMC implemented asset purchases differed in important ways from the manner in which it has historically adjusted the federal funds rate. So with this contrast in mind, I want to raise a set of policy questions that could be considered in designing a purchase program. And I'm really just going to raise these as questions, without definitive answers at this point. First, should the balance sheet be adjusted in relatively continuous but smaller steps or in infrequent but larger increments? The earlier round of asset purchases involved the latter approach, which caused the market response to be concentrated in several days on which significant announcements were made. That might have been appropriate in circumstances where a substantial and front-loaded policy response had benefits, but different approaches may be warranted in other circumstances. Indeed, it contrasts with the manner in which the FOMC has historically adjusted the federal funds rate, which has typically involved incremental changes to the policy instrument. Second, how responsive should the balance sheet be to economic conditions? Historically, the FOMC has determined the federal funds rate based on the committee's assessment of the outlook for economic growth and inflation. If changes to the balance sheet are now acting as a substitute for changes in the federal funds rate, then one might expect balance sheet decisions to also be governed to a large extent by the evolution of the FOMC's economic forecasts. The earlier purchase program, in contrast, did not demonstrate much responsiveness to changes in economic and financial conditions. Indeed, the execution of the program largely involved confirming the expectations that were put in place by the two early announcements. Third, how persistent should movements in the balance sheet be? An important feature of traditional monetary policy is that movements in the federal funds rate are not quickly reversed, which makes them more influential on broader financial conditions. A change that was expected to be transitory would instead move financial conditions very little. For similar reasons, one could argue that movements in the balance sheet should have some persistence in order to be more effective. Fourth, to what extent should the FOMC communicate about the likely path of the balance sheet? The FOMC often communicates about the path of the federal funds rate or provides other forward-looking information that allows market participants to anticipate that path. This anticipation of policy actions is beneficial as it brings forward their effects and thus helps to stabilize the economy. For the same reason, providing information about the likely course of the balance sheet could be desirable. In fact, such communication might be particularly important in the current circumstances because financial market participants have no history from which to judge the FOMC's approach and anticipate its actions. Fifth, how much flexibility should the FOMC retain to change its policy approach? The original asset purchase programs specified the amount and distribution of purchases well in advance. However, the FOMC would be learning about the costs and benefits of its balance sheet changes as it implemented a new program. This might call for some flexibility to be incorporated into the program, providing some discretion to change course as market conditions evolve or as more is learned about the instrument. Okay, so let me go ahead and turn to some concluding thoughts. So I hope my remarks today have offered some insight into the recent balance sheet programs undertaken by the Federal Reserve. Adjustments to the size of the Federal Reserve securities holdings are a new policy instrument for the FOMC. That presents challenges, both to policymakers in terms of determining how to use the instrument, and to market participants in terms of anticipating that usage and understanding its effects. Given these challenges, I believe it is important for the Federal Reserve to communicate effectively about the factors affecting its balance sheet decisions and the implementation of those decisions. In my view, the evidence suggests that the expansion of the securities portfolio to date has helped to foster more accommodative financial conditions, and further expansion would likely provide additional accommodation. Of course, whether the FOMC decides to take such a step will be determined by its assessment of whether the benefits of additional policy stimulus outweigh the perceived costs of expanding the balance sheet. Thank you. You want me to stay here?
Sure. So, thanks, Brian. There are a number of questions. You started with some of the operational guidelines of your kind to give us a sense of the operational day-to-day of your job. So there's some questions with regard to operations. With regard to SOMA, there are limits and caps on percentages of any outstanding security that can be purchased, or I guess there's a question. And what are the longer term, are there any longer term implications or considerations for limitations on securities or particular segments of marketplaces?
So I think what's most important is the general principle I talked about in the speech of conducting the purchases in a manner that's respectful to market functioning while still meeting the economic objectives of the committee. In terms of specific limits, right now we do have in place a 35% limit on our holdings of any individual CUSIP. And we are, we are honoring that limit for now. But, you know, that is a self-imposed limit and certainly could be changed. The spirit of that limit is exactly what I talked about in the speech to support market functioning. So I think it will be evaluated, over time. But for now, it's certainly in place. One thing to note is that, one concern about owning too much of an individual CUSIP is you'll obviously affect the liquidity of that CUSIP and perhaps, lead to greater scarcity and a premium. I think we should note that the way we buy assets, we do it on a relative value basis. So if the market really feels like it has short supply of particular CUSIPs and our holdings are crowding out the market, well, that will be reflected in the price, and that will very naturally lead us to buy less of that CUSIP just in the way we conduct operations.
It's interesting you raise that because you do operate in both the nominal treasury market and the inflation protected treasury market. Can you give us any guidance on the balance and the decisions? Is it a relative value decision between the two? Is it a function of market sizes? And interestingly, is there a feedback mechanism to the Federal Reserve in terms of change, if you don't balance those purchases correctly, interfering with the signal from inflation expectations, and how does that get weighed in your decisions? And is it your group that makes the decision between nominals and reals, or is that a directive from the FOMC?
Okay. It is our group, and that's an area where we have discretion. Even though we're concentrating our purchases in the nominal curve between 2 and 10 years, as I mentioned in the speech, we are buying outside that sector, and outside that sector includes TIPS. I think we gauge the size of the TIPS purchases based on the size of the market and an assessment of market functioning. And let me just make a broader point, which is that, you know, I talk about the objective of asset purchases as making financial conditions broadly more supportive of growth and of lowering longer-term interest rates. I think it's fair to say that the focus is on longer-term real interest rates. If the program is successful, the objective is to lower longer-term real interest rates. And in an ideal world, break-even inflation rates would essentially be priced in a way that reflects the FOMC's success at over time returning inflation to the level that the FOMC sees as consistent with its mandate. So that market signal is important. It's one of many market signals about inflation expectations that the FOMC looks at. But I would expect us to be operating primarily on real interest rates and to let the market price the outlook for inflation in the break-evens.
Okay. You talked a lot about the portfolio balance effects of balance sheet policy and the transmission through financial conditions. So there's a question which is, Why not get the most bang for the buck? Why limit yourself to mortgages and treasuries and not further and move further out the risk spectrum? And in fact, purchase equities or high yield bonds to help that transition mechanism and bring down those risk premiums.
The first thing to note is that would be illegal under the Federal Reserve Act. So there's that.
Minor limitation.
right now, we have the capacity to buy treasuries, agencies, MBS, a few other securities, but we don't have a free choice to move out the risk spectrum as much as we want. So that leads us to these programs of focusing on duration risk. But I think it's important to note that, the programs focus on duration risk, we hope will have broad consequences across all financial markets, right? Most financial instruments have some degree of duration or in some way are arbitrage or are substitutes for longer-term treasury instruments. So I think by affecting the term structure of risk-free returns, we think essentially we should be touching the prices of all assets in the economy. And doing it this way, allows financial markets to still price risks based on their perceptions, to allocate capital across different segments of the economy as is seen appropriate, just relative to a lower return structure on risk-free assets. So it does have, besides the legal issues, I think it does have some appealing attributes as well.
Maybe just a quick related question. I think I probably know what your answer, or I think we probably all would know what your answer is. But the application of 13.3 and the exigent circumstances to buy outside of the realm of what is permissible, which I think is Treasury agency and some short-dated muni bonds, is the hurdle for 13.3 higher than it has been in the past?
So most importantly, we should just bear in mind, 13.3 allows us to provide financing against those types of collateral, right? So even within 13.3, there are important limits on our ability to simply go out and assume the risk of those assets, unlike duration risk, where we can go out and purchase the assets and shift the risk directly onto our books. In terms of hurdles, the Dodd-Frank legislation involved 13.3 and imposed some conditions. I think the conditions are largely in the spirit of 13.3, that it's a tool to be used in unusual circumstances and it should be well collateralized. But I think the spirit's the same, but there's a few additional hurdles here.
So you bring up sort of focusing the risk on duration risk, and so there are a number of questions with regard to the implications of duration risk for the Fed's balance sheet and the Fed's portfolio, and there are obviously yield curve implications. Do you worry about the interest rate component of balance sheet purchases, or is that less of a consideration? So would you
worry about the risk on, of our own?
Do you worry in the management of the sovereign portfolio of rising interest rates and declining bond prices over over a foreseeable time horizon outside of 3, 6, 12, 18 months?
Okay, so let me make a couple of notes about that. So we're talking about a portfolio balance channel. So that channel only works if we shift risk from the markets onto the Fed's balance sheet. So there should be no confusion or no mistake that that we've put duration risk onto the Fed's balance sheet. But I think there's a couple important things to keep in mind. First of all, the FOMC has a mandate that has to do with economic outcomes. So it's it's not clear, I'd say, how to weigh the risks on the Fed's balance sheet against the economic objectives of the FOMC. And the FOMC has to determine that trade-off if it thinks taking that risk produces sounder or better economic outcomes, then it may be willing to do so, and indeed it has been willing to do it already. Another point to note, if losses were suffered on the Fed's balance sheet, it has no operational consequences on our ability to conduct monetary policy. I think it's a very important point to realize. It will affect the amount of revenue that we remit to Treasury, which is an important consideration. But just to be clear, in no way would it affect our ability to conduct operations or set monetary policy. The last thing I'd note is, even though the returns on the portfolio are secondary to the economic objectives, what's taken place so far, we've actually realized a very sizable return on the asset purchase programs. If we look at the excess coupon income that we've received to date, and we add in the unrealized gains we've already realized on the assets we purchased, I roughly calculate that we have a profit of somewhere between $125 and $150 billion on what we've done so far. Again, that's not the focus of the program, but it at least gives us a better starting point thinking about another round of purchases, because I think when we go back and look at the portfolio, look at these programs, and if this issue comes up about whether they involve too much risk, I think we want to look at the return over the complete program, and in some sense we're off to a good start. But certainly the most important point is that these decisions are being made to produce economic outcomes. They're not being made to produce a certain return on the portfolio. And that's why I started my speech by noting, we're a big player in markets and we're different, okay? We manage a portfolio differently than any other market participants because we have a very different objective than other market participants. So that's why I think it's important to kind of understand our decisions and to understand how we may operate and what it may mean for markets.
So you raise the purpose of many of these programs is to have an economic impact. There some have noted questions here and also in the markets that there is perhaps an inconsistency between a central tendency or an FOMC forecast for not spectacular, but rather okay growth in the context of 2011, and a discussion of the next phase of balance sheet management. Is there a sequencing there in which the FOMC has to signal declining or diminishing growth expectations before implementation of a new program, or are they coincident?
So here, I think this is exactly the area where I would I look to comments by FOMC members and look at communications in the minutes and statements and so on. I think the idea is that the FOMC is expecting an economic recovery, and the decision about whether to do more is going to depend on how robust that recovery is and how much confidence it feels it has in that recovery. But in terms of the exact thresholds, it's impossible for me to answer that. I think that's what you need to be paying attention to their communications on.
I mean, to be fair, though, the range of opinions on the FOMC with regard to this is pretty broad and wide. And you talk about the importance of communication and presenting a viewpoint. It in some regards, is very difficult for market participants to do so, given that there are the frequency and range of commentary by FOMC members is pretty broad.
And I think that reflects that these are really challenging issues. I mean, I talked, the chairman put this in this cost-benefit framework, and as I noted in the speech, it is very difficult to calibrate the costs and the benefits. So to do both sides of this assessment is challenging, and it's challenging because this is an instrument that we haven't used historically. So normally, if we were in a world of a positive funds rate and we were talking about good old-fashioned monetary policy, as you know, there's often a lot of disagreement about that. But that's with an instrument that we all kind of understand and have a lot of experience with and so on. Here we're talking about using an instrument that we don't have experience with, that there's a range of views regarding its effectiveness. And so I think it's natural that there are differing opinions. I agree. It makes the communications challenging, and it makes it challenging for you to listen to those and figure out which way it's going. But I think, as the FOMC reaches decisions, that's when it'll be important to communicate those to the markets.
So you talk about Fed funds hitting the zero bound and the importance of balance sheet management as a tool in the operation of monetary policy. It would seem, in some regards, it's the only tool. Are there others that are possible at this point?
Well, the chairman mentioned two others, so changing interest rate on reserves and using policy guidance language more aggressively. But certainly, the focus of everyone seems to be. Let me be clear: the focus of the markets seems to be on the balance sheet right now.
Some questions with regard to some of the implications of balance sheet management and quantitative easing, and one obvious one being the obvious decline in the dollar of late. I'm sure you can't comment directly on dollar policy, but is there a consideration for market implications outside of, or extended market implications outside of the functioning of treasuries, mortgages, and financial conditions generally?
I think I'll just say that, the objective of the asset purchase programs would be to make broader financial conditions more accommodative. I don't think there's some special focus on the dollar or that it plays some disproportionate role in that. It's financial conditions more broadly. Just leave it at that.
Okay. When you talked a little bit about changing the design of the program, I think to some, or maybe to put it another way, you have previously focused on quantity and not price as an implication or as a desired outcome. Is there a point to which you would be worried about the size of the balance sheet, and a point, is there a limit on balance sheet expansion?
I think some of the things I talked about in the speech apply to this. There's a market functioning aspect of this, so that presumably puts some limit on the pace and amount of purchases that can be conducted. And there are others as well. So I didn't go through all the costs of balance sheet expansion. And I think there's a broader range of potential costs outside of market functioning. I limited my remarks to market functioning. But I think, that question, you could apply it to all the costs, potential costs that FOMC members have discussed. So I think the issue is, do those costs put a limit on things? In terms of the single cost that I discussed, market functioning, of course, there's at some point you're going to harm market functioning. If you buy the entire market, obviously you're going to harm market functioning. So it probably does impose a limit. The important or the difficult part is determining, you know, where that limit is. And so I think I was as specific about that as I could be in my speech.
That's fair. Some discuss or debate whether or not developed markets or developed economies, particularly the United States, is in a liquidity trap. That phrase gets used periodically. The best offense against a liquidity trap would be a coordination between a monetary and a fiscal authority. It would seem as if the fiscal authority or the degrees of freedom on the fiscal authority at this point are restrained. Does that impact the effectiveness of future quantitative programs or balance sheet programs, and does that factor into the discussion or the decisions?
Well, I think the fiscal policy outlook affects the outlook for the economy, and therefore gets weighed in the monetary policy decisions. And so, I think through that channel, that's how monetary policy decisions have to take into account fiscal policy decisions.
That probably covers. I guess there's one last question maybe with regard to market functioning. The balance between thinking about treasuries, the effectiveness of implementing the balance sheet policy through purchase of treasuries or the purchase of mortgages. Are there any lingering market impacts from the first program in purchasing mortgages that would change the nature of a future mortgage purchase program if that were deemed to be the most effective means?
Well, I mentioned that the pace of purchases at the height of the program, had some consequences for market functioning, and those consequences persisted. The market had problems with the settlement of some of the higher coupons. At the end of the day, we actually coupon swapped out of some of our 5.5 purchases into 4.5 to facilitate that process. But I think, at this point, the market's getting new supply of securities. It's getting it from the pay down of our holdings, and I think market functioning has improved from that time. But I think, yes, we want to look at that and keep that perspective in mind when thinking about the asset purchase program if the FOMC were to move in that direction. And as I mentioned, the minutes and the chairman's speech in Jackson Hole talked about the possibility of purchasing MBS depending on market conditions. Without being specific about what those conditions were, I mentioned in my speech kind of relative pricing, which would be a natural condition to keep in mind in determining which assets to buy. But I think more broadly, looking at a range of measures of market function would be relevant as well.
Thank you, Brian.
Yeah, thanks.